Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and this is Cape Up. From the coronavirus pandemic to the quest for statehood, there's a lot going on here in Washington, D.C., and smack in the middle of it all is Muriel Bowser, the 8th mayor of the District of Columbia. In this conversation, recorded during a Washington Post Live event on May 6th, we got into all of that. But the number one question folks in Washington asked me to ask Mayor Bowser was this: when will she lift the COVID restrictions on dancing at event venues? The mayor made no news with her response, but where she did make news was on the future of Black Lives Matter Plaza. Hear Mayor Bowser talk about how the big, bold yellow letters that define it came into existence, and what will happen to it now that Donald Trump is out of the White House right now.
Joining me now is the 8th mayor of the District of Columbia, Muriel Bowser. Mayor Bowser, welcome back to Washington Post Live.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan, for having me.
So, Mayor Bowser, I do these interviews all the time, and I've never received more email for one interview than for this one. On May 1st, you I'm not kidding around. Your order requiring guests at weddings and one-time events to stay seated and socially distant went into effect. The key part of the order for those who emailed reads, standing and dancing receptions are not allowed. Why not? And how will that be enforced?
Well, Jonathan, actually what the May 1st order did was open those venues for the first time since the pandemic has affected us and affected the world. We're very pleased that our businesses and residents have strictly followed public health guidance that's allowing us to begin to turn that dial and open up the city. So we have fans in our sporting venues. We have guests at our restaurants, indoors and outdoors. Our public facilities are opening. And yes, now we can have regional meetings and weddings in our convention center and in our and in all of our hotel venues. We are very focused, however, on making sure we're maintaining physical distance, and that's been the case throughout the pandemic.
So, I mean, even Maryland and Virginia are allowing dancing if you're masked and socially distanced. Why not allow for that, at least here in the district?
Well, we think and we expect that given our case rates and how they're going down even more quickly than we thought, that we will be able to ease restrictions across the board. And we're looking forward to being able to do that very soon.
Can you put a timeline on very soon? Or I mean, it's only May 6th. Could it be before the end of this month, before Memorial Day?
I think what we've seen and what we've done throughout the pandemic was look at the dates at which we turn up activity, which was on May 1st, watch what that could do to our case rates. They could go up or they can continue to go down, which we fully expect. And then after a reasonable time watching that turned up activity and what it does, then we can turn up more activity. And that's what we expect. We've also been very focused since this vaccine is now plentiful and in some cases exceeding the demand that we see across the city. We have about 36% of our residents that are fully vaccinated. We know we've got to do a lot better in order to protect our residents. So it's not only that we want to get open, we want to stay open. And the way to do that is to make sure that more and more people are getting vaccinated. I think the president is right to challenge us to look to July 4th to get to a 60-70% vaccination rate among adults. I think we all need to stay focused on that. Turning up activity, yes, but turning up vaccination is even more important.
Let's talk more about the changes you made to the city's mask mandate, because there was some confusion. Can you take us through those changes? What exactly are they?
There was some confusion. There was a mistake in an order that came out of our office, but there was not a mistake in the guidance issued by our health department. We've tried to stay in lockstep with the CDC when it comes to mask mandates, and we continue to be closely aligned with where they are. I think what our residents and everyone can appreciate is that outside activity, especially among your family, where you can be 6 feet apart, you don't need to wear a mask.
Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York stunned many on Monday, announcing plans to almost fully reopen by May 19th. New Jersey, as I mentioned before, New Jersey and Connecticut will join New York in that effort. What are they doing right that the district could or should emulate?
Well, I think they were crushed by this virus, certainly early on, and we didn't experience that level of infection or death or have the experience that they had with their hospital capacity. So I'm quite proud of the district's response to COVID. We were very aggressive in mask mandates and also restrictions that have kept our residents safe. We thought at the beginning of this, Jonathan, that by November of last year, we would have seen over thousands of more infections than we saw. And we thought that we would hit some really high death numbers. We were able to avert that experience, flatten the curve, while providing relief to our businesses. And our residents have been very, very supportive of that approach. As we move forward, you know, I don't know all the details of the health experience of all the states, but I am very familiar with ours. And I'm very familiar with the reopen metrics that we laid out. What we're very focused on is the level of spread in the community. And I have to say that over the last 10 days, since kind of the end of, you know, the late part of April to now, we've seen our case rates go down. And we have a metrics that, you know, is red, yellow, and green. And it's fast approaching being in the green, which means we're getting closer and closer to not needing the types of business restrictions that we put in place.
So then does that mean that the limits on bars and restaurants that we have here in the district could go the way of what Governor Hogan in Maryland has done, which is to completely lift the restrictions, capacity restrictions in bars and restaurants?
I think that you will see the capacity restrictions go up. And I think that we are going to continue to be concerned about physical distancing inside, outside. And as I explained to a lot of folks, and we should think about taking advantage of this wonderful weather. I say to everybody, the outdoors is king right now. So how can we maximize our experiences outdoors? We made some pretty remarkable changes to the use of our public space in the pandemic. And I actually think that you're going to hear mayors talking about reclaiming public space. That's certainly what we're talking about in the district. So now that we can make some of the things that we did really quickly to pivot permanent parts of our landscape, and we know that streeteries is one of them. We have made a pretty profound proposal to change our alcohol regulations to also support how our restaurants can do business and how people can experience the public space.
Mayor Bowser, how worried are you about competition from Maryland and Virginia and other places that are opening up more quickly than Washington in terms of losing business to those jurisdictions?
Well, I'm concerned in the short term, and I'm concerned in the long term. And I think that, you know, what's interesting to talk about is how in urban areas we're attracting people back to work and back to our downtown. What we haven't talked about today is how many people are going to be coming to their offices. I'm in downtown DC right now. I'm at a WeWork location. We have a wonderful partnership with WeWork. But I also know that a lot of our downtown employees are doing various levels of remote work. And what makes cities so vibrant is that the people coming to their offices, having the synergies among coworkers around projects. And so we're challenging our team to make sure that we're getting more and more of our employees back. People frequently talk about reopening without talking about workers. We want our restaurants to be at full capacity just as soon as possible. But I know they won't really be at full capacity because their customers are working at home. And so the way that we can make sure that everybody feels safe coming back to work is to crush this virus and get people vaccinated. We're also very focused on bringing back our tourists. The Smithsonian announced last week that they're opening throughout the month of May, all of our wonderful free museums. And so that people are going to begin to make trips who live in the region, who live outside of the region, and take advantage of the wonderful free museums available in the nation's capital.
Earlier on in our conversation, you talked about some of the good news in terms of the metrics of what's happening with the virus in the district. They're continuing to improve. Last week, you announced 10 new walk-up mass vaccination sites, and everyone over the age of 16 is eligible. But demand for the vaccine has fallen off. Why is that?
Well, we know that we went through a period where the vaccine was scarce and the vaccine eager. We're really fighting to get in line and get the vaccine. And in a matter of weeks, Jonathan, that changed. All of the folks who are eager to get it have gotten it. And now we need to work on making sure that people who need more information are getting information. People who have access issues, whether it's to the internet or to a ride, are getting that access as well. And we are also encouraged by the news that we could have a vaccine for younger children from the age of 12 and up. And we have to make sure that all the systems are a go so families know how to take advantage of the vaccine for their kids as well. But this is the real work of public health and communication from public officials to get people to get out and get vaccinated. We, for example, I think just last weekend, we had a door-to-door grassroots campaign where we had 1,000 volunteers come out to knock on neighbors' doors to tell them, look, I had the vaccine. This was my experience. And this is how we're able to get back to a better normal in our city when people are protected and get the vaccine.
Madam Mayor, according to a report in Washington City Paper in December, here's a quote, preliminary local survey data from DC Health shows that about 44% of Black residents polled were hesitant or resistant to getting the coronavirus vaccine. That was in December. Have those numbers improved?
I think they are improving. And I think that I like to make a distinction between the vaccine hesitant, which I think most of our residents fall into that category, and the vaccine opposed. I think we have a much smaller number of vaccine opposed. And I think the vaccine opposed who are African-American aren't that much different than the vaccine opposed who are white Americans. So that is the group that we have to work on are the hesitant, the people who, if they have a lot of information, if people they know encourage them, if it's convenient and close, then they will get it. And we're continuing to work with them. We're also thinking about more incentives for our residents and workers and the places where vaccines are going to be required. Like, I'm a big proponent of what our universities are doing and requiring their students to come back to DC fully vaccinated.
Now, in this Leadership in Crisis series, we've interviewed a good number of mayors and governors over the last year. And we often ask them what lessons they've learned during the pandemic. So what did you get right? And what do you think you missed during the last 14 months?
Oh, those are big questions. And I know people are going to write about them for years to come. And I may be the wrong person to ask because we're still in the midst of it. I know that one of the key things, and you'll like this as being a person in journalism, I think, is to just communicate and over communicate. And communicate some more. We went into this, Jonathan, at the early parts of our response. We were having daily press conferences. And our team, my comms team, my agency directors, my emergency response team, and our Department of Health have been just incredible at providing DC residents with data and the facts and all the things that they need to know to keep themselves safe. So that's one thing that we continue to work on and continue to get right. We have also had a great collaboration with our legislative branch. And when you're operating in an emergency posture, having those lines of communication open has helped us provide relief programs, like making sure unemployment programs are funded and working. The bridge program that we've done to provide local support to our restaurants and businesses, that has been really key to our ongoing response.
Let's talk about statehood. The bill for DC statehood passed the House last month. Now it sits in the U.S. Senate, where Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia has said he's not keen on voting on it. He thinks it should be done by constitutional amendment. He thinks that should be required, not by Congress. Is he right? And if not, what's the plan for Senate passage?
Well, let me just say this. I don't think we're in any different place than before those comments that Senator Manchin made. We were always going to have to get more support in the Senate. What's different from the last time the House voted on DC statehood is that we have two huge allies for statehood, and that's the President of the United States and Joe Biden. And now we have a Democratic majority led by Chuck Schumer. And so as long as the Senate and the President is pushing for passage of DC statehood, we're going to follow their lead and rely on them and their strategy to get big things done in the Senate, just like they were able to do with the American Rescue Plan. You ask me if the senator was right in saying that a constitutional amendment is required for DC statehood. He is not right if that's what he said. We know that all of the states outside of the first 13 have been admitted to the union by the Congress. It is the exclusive power of the Congress to pass by simple legislation the admission of new states. And so that it's clear, that has been clearly made by constitutional scholars. We in our Admissions Act that is at the Senate now make very clear what the boundaries of the federal district will be. And that is clearly stated and there's no constitutional ambiguity about it.
In your answer, you also raise a good point. You've got the president backing statehood, Democrat. You've got the Senate Majority Leader backing statehood, Democrat. 93% of Washingtonians voted for President Joe Biden in the November election. So what do you say to the Republican opponents who say that granting the district statehood is a quote unquote power grab? Do they have a point?
No, they don't have a point, because we made the same argument when Republicans were in charge. For us, it's not a partisan issue. It's a matter of fairness. And it's a matter if we're going to live up to our democratic principles. Our country was founded on the principle of people who are taxed have to be represented. And in the nation's capital, we're being taxed and we're not represented. There are a lot of misconceptions about what DC is. We're unique. We know that in the democratic system. But what is true is that we pay more taxes than most. We're a donor to the federal government and that we pay more than we get back. Yet we do not have two senators. Our congresswoman does not have a vote. So literally when the important topics of the day are being considered, and the Hill, you know, which many Washingtonians could look out their door and see the Capitol building. We don't have a vote. On January 6th, when our officers were called to assist the United States Capitol Police, where they were injured, where they put their lives on the line, they don't have a vote. They literally don't have a vote. So that's un-American, and it is within the power of the Congress to change it.
Go to an audience question here, and Richard from Maryland, I will apologize in advance for messing up your last name. Richard Zert from Maryland asks, Mayor Bowser, will you consider retrocession to Maryland? And if not, why not? That's actually a position I believe Senator Susan Collins of Maine made last weekend on CNN. Your answer to Richard's question.
So here's the question. Would the senator from Maine consider going back to Massachusetts? Likely not. We have a 200-year experience with being the nation's capital, an identity as the nation's capital. We've developed a government as the nation's capital. And that is what the residents of the district sent me to do, to make sure that Washington, D.C. became the 51st state. We've had a referendum on this question, and that referendum was approved by 86% of DC voters.
Let's talk about the events of almost a year ago. Washington was the site of major protests after the murder of George Floyd in Minnesota. Reflect on the role of then President Donald Trump in the charged atmosphere here in Washington then.
Well, you know, it's so incredible how different it is in the last 5 months of just having stable leadership at the White House. And quite frankly, I don't even think I appreciated how charged and toxic, you know, a situation was that we were living in. But the president, even, you know, before the protests began in real numbers, made some incendiary comments that I found to be racially charged and signaling what their true intent was days before the protests began in earnest. And we saw him kind of live out the rhetoric that he was spewing. He said something like, we are going to unleash violent dogs, or, you know, look out, be on the, you know, so I knew then that it could be bad with this president, you know, inciting just violent speech that was meant to trigger for many people a dark time in American history. Where Americans experience police unleashing dogs on American citizens. And I knew in the pit of my stomach what we had to brace ourselves for.
Let's talk about Black Lives Matter Plaza, which was a genius move. I think I told you at the time, and a genius move that was emulated in other cities across the country. But it also provided a focal point that helped keep demonstrators, which was a concern at the time, to keep demonstrators from spreading out across the city. The name is stretched on 16th Street between H and K Streets Northwest. That stretch has been officially named, renamed Black Lives Matter Plaza. But are the big, bold, iconic yellow letters permanent on that stretch of 16th Street?
Well, they are. In fact, right now we're undergoing a process to make the installation more permanent, and with lighting and landscaping and all the things that you expect in an iconic art installation. And you're right to point out, Jonathan, we had just an unprecedented experience with the President of the United States taking over DC streets. I had the experience of walking from my office at City Hall over to in front of Lafayette Square and seeing, you know, streets, our streets, DC streets, blocked by unidentified federal forces with long guns. In, you know, the clergy who were trying to go on the walk, you know, just everybody was blocked. And so we thought, what a better way to not only take back our street and get them off of our street and keep them from blocking DC residents and members of clergy and anybody else who wanted to walk down the street, but to install this piece of art with a very affirming message that not only our residents needed to hear, but people around the world needed to hear. And they needed to make sure, and they really appreciated that Donald Trump couldn't avoid it. We are going to make that installation, and we're improving it actually right now, and it will be a permanent art installation in the district.
I was there when you and now the late Congressman John Lewis, when he visited Black Lives Matter Plaza. It was June of last year. Can you reflect a little bit on what that was like for you to be there with him?
It is, you know, there are a lot of great perks to a job like this, but I have to put that as tops among them. I'd gotten a chance to meet and spend a lot of time with the congressman in Selma, probably about a year, maybe 2 years before that
on the trip.
Pilgrimage to Selma. And it was amazing. Even then, I was struck by how generous he was with his time. I think what he knew and what maybe I underappreciated was, you know, he saw this as a time to educate leaders coming behind him and make clear to us that it's our turn. It's our turn to take the baton, exercise moral leadership, and lead and do the right things to make our country more fair and more just. He saw the importance not only of being at Black Lives Matter Plaza, and he knew, I think, that, you know, he was definitely facing the twilight of his life, but it was also a full circle moment for him because he kind of looked at me, and I don't know if you overheard him say, he looked at one of the hotels, the Hilton there, that's there in the corner. He said, you know, that's where I stayed right before the March on Washington. At the time, he was the last living speaker from the March on Washington that happened at the Lincoln Memorial when Dr. King delivered his famous words. And he was just kind of, I could see that he was reliving that moment, and it was a full circle moment for him. So we know that he's a son of the South, but I also felt privileged as the D.C. mayor that he saw D.C. He had a place for D.C. In his heart too.
Mm-hmm. I want to say we're running out of time, but I have to squeeze in two more questions. The council just made permanent Robert Conte, a veteran of the district's police force. They made him the new police chief. What are his plans to address escalating violence in the district? The district hit a 16-year high in homicides in 2020. On Sunday, 8 people were shot in Washington. What are his plans?
Well, you ask a question that all my colleagues in big cities are facing, increased levels of violence, while at the same time, all of us are working with our residents, our legislators, to make sure that we're really looking at policing and making sure policing is focused on the things that are going to keep our residents safe. So I have to answer your question in a long way, that the police are focused on law enforcement, but all of the agencies of our government, and I'm asking all of our communities too, to be focused on how we can prevent crime. We started a new initiative called Building Blocks, which is focused, Jonathan, on the small number of people who are creating the most violence in our city and the relatively few locations where most of that violence happens. So in concert with our law enforcement efforts, we're very focused on prevention efforts. And right now, thanks to the American Rescue Plan, we have lots of federal investments that are going to allow us to focus on those intense efforts to try to change the trajectory of people who have been involved in cycles of violence.
All right, I'm going to give the last question to an audience member. And this last question comes from Scott Van Beck from Vermont. What's next for you politically?
Well, you know, I had the best job in Washington. You've heard me say that 1,000 times. I'm a 2-term mayor, and that's saying something in D.C. I was the first 2-term mayor in 16 years in Washington. So, and I'm incredibly energized by what the work we have ahead. COVID has been an unprecedented demand on how cities operate, how city government operates. But what's going to be really fun and interesting is how we focus on our comeback. How do we bring back our beautiful downtown? How do we help kids and families make up for the time lost in this last year? And how do we focus on a recovery that's more equitable? I think this is going to be some of the most interesting time in local government. And I'm just really proud to get to be the mayor of my hometown.
Muriel,
that's a long
Bowser.
Answer to say.
No. Yeah. Hey, at least you answered the question. But Muriel Bowser,
yes.
Mayor of the District of Columbia, but more importantly, Miranda's mom. Thank you very much for coming back to Washington
Post Live.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.